Hello, America. Dave Hodges here, host of The Common Sense Show. We are the show that is freeing America one enslaved mind at a time. And we have John Thaler back with us. Who's he? He's a RICO investigator, worked in that field. He's done it for over 30 years, successful prosecutions with the federal government, private entities. He's got all the experience you want. And he says that I live in probably the most corrupt state in America, but it's not just confined to America. We're going to look at organized crime influence today and how they steal elections. This will be John's second appearance on our show, and it was so compelling on one. We're going to have him back for two, and I have a feeling we'll have to have him back for three, because I am all over election fraud in Arizona, which is rampant, corruption, which is rampant, and he has cut to the heart of it in a way that I can only dream about getting to. And a lot of people lauded me as doing yeoman's work. Well, if you think I did yeoman's work, this is the Pulitzer Prize of Journalism coming up here with John Thaler. It's absolutely fantastic. Hey, I wanted to let you know that we're brought to you by Noble Gold. And I'm very concerned about the condition of the banks. When you look at Jamie Dimon pulling out a million shares of his own bank, he's never done it before. That should be cause for concern. Add to that the fact that the government can take your money. Oh, they can. And the banks can take your money because of the Dodd-Frank law of 2010. And I say, don't give them the chance. You can't afford to make up your retirement. That's not going to happen. But they can take it. Noble Gold can get your retirement out of the bank, put it under your control, and properly insure it. Additionally, you can save your bank account. You can diversify. They're experts in precious metals. Noble Gold is the very best I've ever encountered, which is why I've been a customer for 5 years. I advertised for six, and it took me about a year to figure out, hey, this is what I need to be doing. So need to give you one disclaimer. The FTC wants me to tell you that there are never any guarantees in investments, and past performance cannot be indicative of future performance. We agree with that warning. Just wish a lot of people would have got that for FTX. Wish they would get it for the fact that the banks can steal your money on a moment's notice, but that's, you know, neither here nor there. We're here to talk about Noble Gold. 877-646-5347. 877-646-5347. And I want to say something before we join John Thaler. When I wrote an article back in May of 2021, I said these are the five ways that the Arizona election was stolen. And I still stand by everything I said in that article. In fact, today has proven me more right than any other time. A lot of people lauded the work. They congratulated me. But the people on the inside, particularly the people of the audit that were hired to do nothing but cover up the theft, they called 13 colleagues of mine and said, Dave Hodges will ruin your reputation if you continue to deal with him. In fact, Paul Preston, my good friend from Agenda 21 Radio, was told, Dave Hodges is going to get you killed to keep talking to him. Yeah, all the reason to talk to John Thaler, and here he is. Hello, everybody. Dave Hodges here. Welcome to the guest segment of the Common Sense Show, and we're rejoined in part two of what we did in part one, which is exploring extreme corruption in the state of Arizona, but it's not the only state. But we're going to focus a lot there, and we're going to be talking today in particular about election fraud. And you say, oh, Dave, that's something you've written a lot about and done a lot of stories on. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think we're the king of election fraud in America. If we're not, we're certainly the prince. But anyway, John Thaler is here. He's written a book called Report to the Governor. It's available everywhere. We'll tell you about that before we leave. And it's groundbreaking. And I'll tell you, affidavit after affidavit about criminal behavior among elected officials, judges, law enforcement. And we went through a lot of that in part one. And you want to check that out if you missed it. But we want to really focus on election fraud. John, thanks so much for coming back on. It's good to have you back.
Well, thank you for having me, Dave. I appreciate it.
Well, I knew on a federal level that when the votes started to change at 1 a.m. in the morning in the six swing states, I knew the fix was in. And Trump knew the fix was in. And he should have done something definitively at that time, seized the voting machines, whatever. But I think his inaction cost him the election. But really, I live in Arizona, and I can tell you that Biden had rallies here where Fox 10 covered it, one rally, and they said, we can't find anybody except the organizers. No one showed up. Trump would have rallies of tens of thousands of people, and no one in this state really believes that Joe Biden got elected. So in your work, when you were pursuing corruption on the part of the officials we've already mentioned, what did you find with regard to election fraud? Walk us through that.
Well, we knew in 2020, in October 2020, that there was fraud going on in elections, and we knew there was going to be fraud in the federal election. We knew that because one of our investigators, actually really a team of our investigators, but one of our primary investigators, had seen and witnessed and recorded and took photos of ballots being, you know, falsified ballots being placed in boxes. We have location where they went, how they do it. You know, one of the things we talk about in the book is exactly what we saw. We have an affidavit from that particular investigator as to what he saw, what he witnessed. There's a lot more to the story than what we have told, and there's a lot of reasons for that, because there are safety concerns involved. There were threats made to a lot of people involved. There was even violence that occurred after this particular incident involved. But essentially what you have is you have the manufacturing of ballots, you know, basically mail-in ballots. You have them being placed into the sealed envelopes, and you have them being taken to the facility that does the counting. That's Runbeck Election Services.
Yeah, that's and Runbeck has been implicated in the 2022 election as well, too.
Right. Let me clarify something on this, too, because I think there's been so much said about election fraud. One of the things that's very important to keep in mind is that we were not hired by anybody in particular to look at election fraud. Election fraud was a natural progression, really somewhat by accident, because of what we were discovering. So nobody came to us, no Republican Party, no Democrat Party, no candidate came to us and said, we need you to look at election fraud. Nobody did that. We stumbled into it because of the falsified document issues that we were already looking at. And this happened to be an offshoot of it. What we found was something far more, I think, dangerous than just simply, you know, harvesting ballots or somebody, you know, printing falsified ballots. So let me go through that a little bit with you so that everybody kind of understands this.
Yeah.
In our research, one of the things that I know you've now seen, because it's in the book, it certainly will be in the footnoted documents, is we have found that there are direct infiltrations into the Maricopa County database. For those who are not familiar, and it's hard to believe anybody isn't at this point, Maricopa County is the county where Phoenix and its suburbs are located. It is the largest area of population in Arizona. It has roughly about 62-63% of the state's population in it.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever you do to control Maricopa County controls how elections go. I mean, that's just the math of it. One of the things that we had discovered was that there were continuing infiltrations into the Maricopa County database. The database was built, the current one was built roughly about 2014 into 2015. It is an integrated database, meaning that it houses everything that the county does. That includes the court system. It includes the recorder's office for recording documents. And it includes, and this is the problem, it includes electronic voting databases. So all the information as it's coming in terms of vote count come into this database. We have proved beyond any doubt whatsoever that the database, the entirety of the Maricopa County database, is compromised. We have the documents. We can show the documents. In the book, we do show the documents to show exactly how this works. And this works in three different levels. With respect to the court system, this works to put into the system, upload into the court system, falsified orders, falsified judgments, things of that nature. It also involves pulling down judgments or orders that have been issued by courts, changing them and reloading them up into the system before they go public, so that anybody who's litigating anything in Arizona, whether it be a criminal case or a civil case, you have no idea and no way of knowing whether or not the documents that you are seeing, the ones that are being mailed or sent to your attorney, sometimes by email, sometimes by direct mail, you have no way of knowing whether those documents are accurate or not. And John, we have found in...
I just want to ask you, when you look at the case, you're looking at cases being altered, falsely entered, and so forth. Is this to establish a fake front for case law precedent?
Usually not, because ultimately, you know, the trial courts don't set precedent. The appellate court and the Supreme Court of Arizona do. So it's not as much as to do precedent. It's to rip people off. In the case of the Maricopa County Superior Court, there's a lot of reasons why it's done. But one of the reasons is, you know, they will hack into this group of thieves will hack into your credit report. They will find areas in your credit report where you might be behind in a payment or didn't make a payment or didn't realize you didn't, could even be from years ago. They will then falsify a judgment in the system against you and then use that judgment to send to you to collect money off of you. You know, essentially either raiding your bank account because they now have a judgment. So they get a judgment, they get what's called a garnishment writ from that to be able to raid your bank account or to be able to send you a letter that says, you know, demand is made that you do this. Otherwise, we're going to raid your bank account. We're going to take money out of your paycheck. And people, you know, because the debt might have been a real debt at some point, so showing up on your credit report, people don't know that the letter is fake, that the lawyers on it may or may not exist, but the letterhead has been falsified. The P.O. box that's almost always used in these cases is a real box, but it's, you know, it's a falsified front. And so people then send money. And you do this with enough victims. You know, you can get $3,000-$4,000 out of each victim. You know, you do 100 victims, that's $300,000. So that's what you're looking at. And so this is used to do criminal restitution orders. It's used to do judgments. It's used to do falsified family court orders. I mean, you name it. And we give examples of this in the book. We actually show you the documents and show you, you know, both from handwriting expert and from what's called pre-flight software. And we can discuss that later if you want. But from pre-flight software, we can show you exactly how the document was falsified, where it was written, how it was written, how it was loaded into the system. If it was a real document at some point, how it was pulled down and modified. We've actually been able to use their system to actually create modified documents that you would not be able to tell were fake. I mean, that's how bad this is. On the recorder side of this, the problem is all sorts of things. A lot of this is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac ripoff. This, you know, in case people aren't familiar, when you get a loan, what's called a conforming loan, which nowadays is a loan below $750,000 for your house, generally that loan is secured. It's obviously provided by a bank or a mortgage company, but it's secured by the federal government under a program from either an organization called Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And what happens essentially is that it allows the bank, if it wants to sell your loan. So even though the bank might still be the one who collects the money, they actually sell the loan. So they make loans, sell the loans at a profit, and then make more loans. And that's how banks operate. Very rarely will you ever, and anybody's had a mortgage for any length of time will know this, rarely do you ever have the same mortgage company on your mortgage, you know, 10 years after you started. You might have gone through two companies, three companies, four companies, but you will not ever have the same mortgage company at the beginning as you have at the end, because these loans get sold. It's kind of how the 2007, 2008 economic panic occurred, was because of the buying and selling of these loans. So what happens is that you've got documents being loaded into the recorder system that are falsified, that are then being taken down and modified as necessary. One of the ones that we show is a Wells Fargo loan on a property where the Wells Fargo document, which was a sale of the loan to Fannie Mae, was uploaded into the system. Then it was pulled back down from the system after it was uploaded, which should be an impossibility, but it was pulled back down, modified with a different handwriting put on it, a different notarization put on it. In fact, it didn't even have, when it was originally uploaded, it didn't even have a notarization. So it had a notarization put on it, it had a new signature put on it, it had new numbers put on it, and then it was reloaded into the system. And then that was used to basically rip off Fannie Mae for the value of a loan that never occurred. So that's a way it's done. So in addition to what we talked about last time, which was the falsification of deeds and the falsification of documents, all of which get uploaded to the system. These are documents that are designed to go into the system to be modified to create a ripoff. So that's the second issue you've got going on. The third one is the election database problem. And that is that, you know, counties are the ones that count votes, not states. Counties do it. Counties then submit that information to the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State then, you know, declares a winner based on those numbers. But the numbers are certified at the county level. Precincts report to the counties. The counties certify those numbers. They go to the Secretary of State. That's the order of things. What you have going on here is you have infiltration into those databases so that as those numbers are coming in, those databases can easily be manipulated. Just as if you're pulling down a document and changing that, just as if you're pulling down a judgment or uploading a judgment that doesn't exist. It's all the same problem. And that's the scarier part, because that bypasses the issues of the machines. You know, for all of the talk of the machines being a problem, and machines are a problem, but for all of the talk of the machines being a problem, this is probably not an election where the machines were the problem. We may have had that in the past. Both Democrats and Republicans, especially in Congress, have, you know, had hearings on this and have all concluded the same thing, that Dominion and these other companies have security flaws, period. And we can talk about that, but for the 2020 and 2022 elections, the Dominion machines are probably the least vulnerable part of the problem.
Right.
And, you know, let me explain it this way. I think the last thing I'll say, and I'll let you ask questions on this. The manner in which elections work with an electoral college, you know, people, you know, a lot of Democrats have said, you know, for years now, they want to abandon the electoral college. Well, guess what? They're actually winning because of the electoral college, not in spite of it. And it's something that they don't understand. This is a mathematical equation. If you have states where there's roughly a 2-3% gap between the candidates, you know, Biden's at 53, Trump's at 47, or really more closely, where Biden or Trump is at 51 and it's 49, you know, where you have a 2% gap between the candidates. Chances are that gap comes from two or three counties. In Arizona, that comes from Maricopa County. There's only one, maybe a little bit from Pima, a little bit from Yuma, but that basically comes from Maricopa County. In other states, there's usually, you know, take Pennsylvania. You know, there's two main cities. There's a lot of small cities that are terrific, but there's two main cities. You know, Pittsburgh, which is in the west, and Philadelphia, which is in the east.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can control a database within a county, if you can control the numbers coming out of a particular database, you can control the entirety of the state. Because again, it's not a popular vote, it's an electoral college. So all you have to do is come out with more votes overall in that state to win that state. And it's a winner take all, with the exception, I think, Nebraska, and I think there's one other state. It's a winner take all. So all you have to do is have manipulations in 10 or so databases throughout the country, and you can actually affect the entirety of a presidential election. Now, this is hard to do if an election is not close. If an election is four, you know, five, six, 7 points away from the two candidates, you can't do this. It becomes too obviously fraud and kind of nonsensical. Too many votes, too many things you have to do. It wouldn't be able to be done. But in any close election, like the ones that we've had, you know, in the last few years, certainly in 2000 we did. Certainly in 2008 it was reasonably close. 2012, 2016, 2020. You know, we have reasonably close elections where all you have to do is manipulate counties, not states, not voting machines. Databases is all you have to manipulate in 10 counties in order to win an election. And that's what people have to understand here. So that when you hear a lot of the bluster about election fraud, the fraud part is probably true, but the bluster part sometimes isn't. And it's because no one, until we came along and started discovering what we discovered in Maricopa County, you know, most people had never thought of this. And why would they? You know, most people don't sit around thinking about fraud. But if you're into election integrity, if that's an issue for you, you know, again, whether you're a candidate or not, or whether you're a professional, if election integrity matters, this is what you have to think about. You have to sit around and thinking, all right, voting machines are too easy. You know, it's what everybody claims. What can I do to affect the outcome of an election? What creative things can I think of? And had anybody really thought this through, this is where they would have looked. Like I said, this we stumbled on. This was not something we were originally asked to look at. It's something we stumbled onto because of what we found in 2020. One thing that should be said, because I talk about it in the book, is that on the night of the election in November 2020, I was actually being chased all over the state by a group of what were allegedly officers from the city of Mesa, literally on election night, so that I could not see what was going on. Because we had already 1 month earlier already determined that there was fraud going on in the election, at least in Arizona. And so I had about 7:30 at night, I had a knock on the door of where I was at by four individuals dressed as officers who were not. who then proceeded to chase me around to try to prevent me from being able to see what was going on. I talk about that story in the book. It's you know, a fascinating tale of what happened and how, you know, why that was. But this is what occurred. And, you know, it came hand in hand with one of my clients being beat up in my home, which happened, you know, this happened about 2 weeks earlier. That's also told in the book. There's also a declaration from that individual as to what happened. I was not in my home overnight. I was with a client. I was outside of Arizona. And, you know, four individuals dressed as Mesa police officers broke into my home, which was in Gilbert. They thought that the individual in the home was me, and they proceeded to severely beat him within an inch of his life. When they realized it wasn't me, they then tied him up and threw him into the garage while they ransacked my house. You know, like I said, that's the kind of thing I've been dealing with now, you know, for the last 4 years. So with that in mind, you know, our take on election fraud is obviously very different than others. Again, we're not looking at the Dominion machines. We're looking at two aspects. We're looking at the ability to manipulate databases. And the other aspect is the signatures on you know, mail-in ballots.
Right.
Let me just say two things about the mail-in ballots, too, so that we're clear on that. Because we have done so much investigation into signatures and handwritings, as you probably know, I know a lot of people haven't seen it yet. It will be it is in the footnote section. We've got about 1,700 pages, and I think that even may be an underestimate, of forensic handwriting, forensic question document expert reports to go along with what we're saying. So we don't just say it. We've had some of the top experts in the country evaluate our documents. You know, unlike the Arizona legislature that said, oh, well, we look at this and there's no fraud here. Yeah, we actually hired experts. We actually have them write reports. You can't find anybody in the legislature who did any of this of the sort. They didn't hire any experts. They didn't look at any reports. These were all, remember, these were all offered to them as well. But one of the things that we discovered, you know, in that mail-in ballot problem and those mail-in ballots being taken, is we were able to get a hold of a number of mail-in ballot signatures. Now, one of the things that happens in especially in Maricopa County is that the mail-in ballot program is huge. It started in the 90s. This is not new. So for people who think this is something the Democrats came up with a year ago, it's not. The mail-in ballot program started in the 90s, but it's become such that something like, I think, you know, of the roughly 7 million voters in Arizona in any, you know, any given presidential election, you have roughly almost 3 million of them voting by mail-in ballot. And of that, you have about 1.3 million voting by mail-in ballot in Maricopa County. And that's an extremely, extremely high number, which is a number that already on its face is questionable. But the bigger deal is the signatures. The way in which you vote mail-in is that a ballot is sent to you with an envelope. You mark the ballot accordingly, pretty simple, straightforward. You mark the ballot accordingly, put the ballot in an envelope, and then you have to sign the outer envelope. You do not have to provide any other ID. So you don't provide a picture of your driver's license. You don't have it notarized, nothing. That's all you do. Then what happens is that when that ballot goes to the ballot counting location for Maricopa County, that's a private company called Runbeck Election Services. What's supposed to happen is the ballot goes through a screening, an electronic screening, where the ballot signature, the signature on that outside envelope is compared to the signature of that person. Now, compared to the signature, is usually is either one of two signatures, either a driver's license signature, because we all have to sign our driver's licenses, or if you either don't have a driver's license or sometimes there's a reason for preferences, it doesn't matter here, it's a signature that is on your application for registration. So when you sign an application for registration for voting, your signature is on there. What then happens is the vote goes to a machine. The machine decides whether or not the signatures match. If the signatures match, the vote is then counted. Now, here's the problem. First problem, the system in Maricopa County is set to 10% match, which means all that has to happen is there has to be a 10% match between the mail-in ballot envelope signature and the official signature on file. Anything less than 10%, it gets rejected, but it only has to meet a 10% threshold. This is kind of like a Diebold machine at an airport being turned up so high that almost anything will set off the machine. you know, the little metal on your shoelace, you know, circle, you know, for your shoelaces to go through the little hole, that would set off a metal detector. It's the same problem. So almost everything gets by. If it doesn't get by, for that 10% that doesn't get by, it then gets a hand comparison where, you know, if you remember the 2000 election and people holding up, you know, indented chads and perforated chads and all these things, you've got somebody who literally is supposed to look at the ballot, look at the signature and decide, do these things match? And then if they do, push them through. If they don't, they go into a different pile. From the different pile, the person's supposed to get a phone call. They're supposed to be able to come down and verify their ballot. There's a procedure for that. If it goes through on this second run, then, of course, again, the vote is counted. Here's the problem with that. As Carrie Lake proved in her trial, the average amount of time spent was 1.8 seconds. So the amount of time that a reviewer looked at the ballot envelope signature, looked at the official signature, and then moved it along was 1.8 seconds. Now, what does that really mean in terms of real numbers? Here's what it means in terms of real numbers. In every state that's comparable in terms of mail-in balloting to Arizona, generally speaking, 10 to 12% of the ballots are thrown out in the first run. And ultimately, 1.25% on average are not counted. So for every 100 ballots, you'd have 1.25 that are ultimately not used. That's the easiest way I can explain it. So 125 per 1,000. That's what you would get. Okay. Or sorry, 12.5 per 1,000. That's what you would get. Arizona has a ridiculous number of 0.35, which essentially is a 4 times higher pass right. rate for ballots than every other state. California, 1.25. They have about 9 million mail-in ballots. They throw out 1.25% of them for non-signature matches. Arizona is 0.35%. Give you, again, in terms of real numbers, from that starting of that 1.3 million ballots that are actually cast by mail in Maricopa County, 4,600 are thrown out for signature matching. 4,600 compared to 1.3 million. That's the number. In California, that number would be over 100,000. That's the difference. If the same 1.3 million were done there, it would be over 100,000 votes that would be thrown out. And then what we wound up doing is from that problem, we actually got a hold of a number of mail-in ballot signatures. As you know, these things have been so closely guarded. Maricopa County will not release them. Runbeck, of course, will not release them. As far as we're concerned, that's illegal. That is entirely illegal. But they will not release them so that nobody can do a comparison. They say, well, we did it. No, you didn't. You know, transparency is that we get to do comparisons. No one has ever gotten to. So when Maricopa County says we did all these things and we're so wonderful and there's no election fraud, they are lying to you. They are lying to all of us when they say that. They will not allow the inspection. And the reason they won't is because we did an inspection. We got a hold of about 100 of the signatures from the 2020 election. And we can tell you from the 100 we got, there are no matches. They are not even close. These are ones that were counted. They're not even close. And not only are they not even close, and we've actually posted this on Twitter before. We've actually posted some of these findings before and some of these signatures. I mean, we've let people see these. But not only do they not match, but more importantly, we can actually identify who the signer is, who the forger is. We know who some of the people are who are forging the ballots.
How do you know that?
And yet, according to Maricopa County, oh no, we've done all this. Everything's just fine.
Okay. I got a few questions here. First of all, let's go back to the database infiltration. Did you discover how that was accomplished?
Well, we had a pretty good idea, but I mean, we let's be clear on our terms. There's hacking and there's infiltration. I don't mean to be so picky-une about this, but there's a difference. Hacking is when you've got outside forces, you know, the Russians, the Chinese, who manage to break into the system and make changes. That's what hacking is all about. Infiltration is where the people who built the system built trap doors to be able to get into the system. What we've determined is that when the system was built in 2014 to 15 for Maricopa County, And for a lot of, the state of Arizona, for its various agencies, that the systems were built with the ability of people to get in. They were specifically built that way. Any computer expert will tell you that you can make systems for the most part non-hackable, depending on how much stuff is available to the public and what the public can get into. You can essentially make a system non-hackable if you do. Most hackings come because of an inside vulnerability, and usually one that was intentional. In this particular case, it's our opinion that this was intentional. The manner in which they get into the system, the manner in which the systems work, and communications that we have between individuals who we believe are directly involved in the infiltration, we believe this has always been an inside job and that the database was built this way.
Okay, I understand the building, but is it people that are also monitoring? Are they part of this as well too?
Yes, I would say that not only the architects of the system, but that essentially part of the process of who you hire is those who will do your bidding here. So that you have this, and it's not, and let me give you another example of this, which is a little bit outside of elections. As you know, one of the things that we looked at was the access liens, the AHCCCCS liens. Those are medical liens. That's when you get into a car accident and you're getting treated and the payment for the bill is going to come later. You know, we were able to determine about 25,000 or so falsified access liens filed in at least 8 different counties, over the last 10 years. To a tune of over $100 million. There's no possible way for that to have happened without it being an inside job. So the paperwork can be done anywhere by anyone, and it is. We know who does it. We know where it's done, et cetera. But in order for that to pass without it raising a red flag, and that should raise a red flag, I mean, 25,000 excessive liens, and $100 million of payment shouldn't go by without somebody figuring that out. Any auditor would. And auditors, by the way, have. The problem is that it doesn't happen in the absence of somebody being inside, period. So you have in probably all of these agencies inside folks. Now, with respect to Maricopa County and elections, we, of course, created a video on this, which is available at reporttothegovernor.com, which we've also displayed for people, which shows that there are from Adrian Fontes, but also from Stephen Richer, falsified appointments.
Let me clarify who they are for our audience. Stephen Richer was the Maricopa County Clerk and Recorder. Fontes was his predecessor, who's now the Secretary of State.
Right. And we have shown that when Fontes was the recorder, and now when Richer is, we have got, at least now probably about 30 or so falsified appointments. We had about 14 or 15 under Fontes. We now have about another 14, 15 under Richer. We've been able to identify the handwritings. We've been able to identify who the false, the forged notaries come from, who's actually forging the notaries, et cetera. So you now have people in place who literally don't exist. And the ones who do exist, for a number of reasons, had their appointment documents withheld in such a way so that nobody knew they were even being appointed. In fact, with Fontes, most of the 14 or so appointment documents that we covered, and we covered it in a video, we covered it in about a 30-minute video to show exactly how we investigated, exactly why they're falsified, how we know they are. We had forensic, QDE reports on this, et cetera. One of the things that we did here is we looked at these individuals. Who's the person being appointed? Could we even identify them? And in some cases, there's a couple of people we could identify. However, those people in all cases had their documents withheld until after the election. So you had from late 2019 into September of 2020, you had 14 appointments. None of the appointments were actually recorded for the public to see prior to December 9, 2020. That's after, not only after the election in 2020, but after the certification of the election. Then all of a sudden, those documents are dropped into the recorder's office. That's not supposed to happen. And the actual documentation from the county on these appointments differs, both in terms of dates, times, places, et cetera, from the actual appointment documents. So even the appointment documents don't match up to the county's own records.
And that's so there's no accountability for falsified records. Yeah, exactly.
There's no accountability, and you don't have anybody to call or write because you don't even know this person's in charge.
That makes a lot of sense. I want to go back to 2020 and something I uncovered when I started writing about my concerns about the election, and I was actually even quoting some state senators that said, we're counting votes with people that live at the crosswalk of walk and don't walk. Okay. Sonny Borelli was one of those people. And so I started looking into it from that. And then the election codes issue came up. And when I started writing about this, I actually had three people that anonymously, and I told them I would never expose them, and they have not come forward. But I believe they've been borne out to be true. In this election codes, the people that were on the floor, running an election center, had to have election codes for the machines that were there they're supervising. At least this is what they've all told me. And they said they were never given the codes, and they never got an answer when they asked why they didn't have the codes. And so then they had this big rigmarole where the sheriff came out at a press conference, and Sheriff Penzone said, well, I had the codes for safekeeping. There was no reason for him to have the codes, not one justifiable reason. And then there was two court orders and an attorney general order. You must sacrifice these codes so we can see where the votes were counted and so forth and so on with the machines. And to the best of my knowledge, those court orders were ignored. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, and the court orders were ignored. I'm going to leave out the personalities for the moment. I have worked over the years, beginning roughly in 2011, 2012, when Joe Arpaio, who's fairly famous everywhere, when Joe Arpaio was the sheriff of Maricopa County, I worked with his teams. And just so folks out there know, because we do talk about the Chinese connection in the book, one of the big concerns for Arpaio, beginning roughly in 2010, 2011, 2012, was Chinese interference. So it hasn't gone unnoticed. It didn't get a lot of attention. His department could only do so much. But, that was a concern. And we assisted in some of that investigation because it obviously ran to organized crime. In those days, less so than what looked like the Chinese government. It looked more like organized crime. And so we helped in some of this. Penzone has been an absolute disaster in this. People may like his personality better than Arpaio. There were a lot of issues with Arpaio, especially toward the end of Arpaio's reign as sheriff, which was for a lot of years. But Penzone is, he's not even a useful idiot. He's just an idiot. Penzone is fully aware of almost everything that's in this book. I don't think there's anything in this book that he doesn't know about. But as you'll notice, nobody does an investigation. And even Penzone comes out with these kinds of statements. We've looked at this and we've decided we're not going to give it any more attention. I don't know what that means. Maybe Penzone can come on your show and explain it. But the fact of it is that they're fully aware of the evidence of these things. They're fully aware of the evidence of election fraud. And for a lot of reasons, a lot of which he'll need to explain, they simply don't push the issue. I think there are a lot of reasons for this. Unfortunately, were originally the benefit of all of this went to Republicans. For many, many years, Republicans got the benefit. And the reason Republicans did is kind of interesting. It's not just because Republicans in Arizona, ran the state. It was because businesses in Arizona had deals with illegal immigrants, made deals with illegal immigrants, employed illegal immigrants. We've heard this said before that, immigration, the immigration problem isn't simply, Democrats wanting to fill, the coffers with votes, with new voters. It's not just that. To a large degree, Republican business owners have benefited from the cheap labor. And when the state was more agrarian than it is now it looks more at high tech and other areas. But when the state for many, many years was agrarian, when it grew crops, almost all of Gilbert, was crop growing. Now it's housing development. So you have this change that's occurred over the years. But when this was an agrarian state, cheap labor was the deal. So for many years, Republicans in government looked the other way. And didn't care if elections were defrauded and didn't care, who came in or didn't come into the country because the benefit was to them. Now, when you have a different state and a different climate, so that, now Republicans are very much on closing the border, stopping the movement of drugs, shutting down, fentanyl production, certainly, and distribution. Now it's the Republicans who are on the hot seat because it's the Democrats who won't do that and don't do that. So you've had this shift in really the last, you know, probably about 5 or 6 years. It hasn't really been that long, where now Democrats are getting the benefit of a system that was really created by Republicans.
Yeah, but I look at it almost like a uniparty. And here's why I say that. Stephen Reicher, Republican. Bill Gates, former student of mine, by the way, Maricopa County chairman at the time of the 2022 midterms, they took out a PAC to stop America First candidates like Carrie Lake, the same agreement that Schumer and McConnell had informally. And so here you have GOP working against GOP, but the GOP is working against someone who wants constitutional law, and these people want to participate in the cover-up of stolen elections. And to me, the uniparty runs Arizona. I mean, if I'm off on that, tell us what we should think about this.
No, I think that's how you should think of it. I think it's a little more complicated than that. I know the term uniparty is one that's used widely in Arizona, and it certainly is an issue. Don't think for a moment necessarily that someone like Bill Gates, who's the county supervisor for Maricopa County, that he necessarily has anything in common with Katie Hobbs. They really don't.
No.
But there's been a go along to get along philosophy for a long time.
Right.
The manner in which you rise to office in Arizona is very different than other states. It's a little bit, I kind of liken it a little bit in a weird way to the Pendergast machine in Missouri, you know, that helped, you know, get Harry Truman, you know, through the system, you know, up through being, you know, a local politician to a congressman, ultimately to a senator and ultimately to vice president. It's a machine oriented system. And the machine at the moment, and you know, probably for the last 10 years, if not longer, has wanted anybody who won't close down the border, because closing down the border means stopping billions and billions of dollars. Again, we look at it as drugs, and drugs are obviously the biggest commodity that's coming across the border illegally. But as I said last time, it's like big pharma, it's like big oil, it's like big agra. It doesn't matter what it is. When you have an industry of billions of dollars, you're going to have people who are going to control your politics, who are going to control the statutes. You know, you mentioned statutes earlier. We could talk about one for a moment here, which aids in all of this, and that is a statute that was passed in 2020 regarding notaries. Most people realize, you know, most people obviously have used a notary at some point in their life, so they know what a notary does. They verify that it's you, that it's your signature on a document. They stamp the document, and you take that document to your bank or wherever you need to take it, and everything's fine. It's you. The problem here is that Arizona's notary system is filled with at least 10,000 falsified notaries, people who don't exist, but are notaries in the system. One of the ways they get away with this is because until 2020, a notary stamp did not have to include the notary's number. So all it was a stamp that had the name on it. It had the name on it and the expiration date on it, but didn't have the identifying number. So somebody came up with a great idea. In late 2019, the legislator came up with a great idea. We're going to require the number to go on the stamp. Because guess what? Every other state requires the number go on the stamp. Well, here's what they did. That gets to the legislature. There's only one problem. Each notary in Arizona has two numbers. When you sign up to be a notary, you're given a permanent 7-digit number. That number stays with you the entire time you're a notary. It's a 7-digit number. But because a notary is in business for 4 years, they get a 4-year term before they have to renew. So every 4 years, you've got to renew your stamp. You have to pay a fee, renew your stamp. They get a secondary number, a 6-digit number, which covers that 4-year term. So you have your 7-digit permanent number, like a state bar number. You have your 6-digit 4-year number. The law was, as written, was changed at the last minute, not to require the 7-digit number to go on the stamp, but the 6-digit number. So the only number that goes on a notary stamp starting in May of 2020 is the 6-digit 4-year number. So every 4 years, that's got to be, you know, it's a new number. You get 6-digit number, then another 6-digit number, and so on. Here's the problem. If you go to the notary database in the Secretary of State's office in Arizona, they only can look up the notary by the 7-digit number, the one that's not on the stamp. This is a way in which You control legislature. So somebody in the legislature had a great idea. Let's put the notary number on there so people can identify their notaries. And it gets changed at the last minute so that nobody knows the difference, so that the notary number on there is one that an average individual cannot go and look up and they cannot verify. So if I look at that notary's name, if I get that name and I go to the notary database, I can get their name, I can get their 7-digit number, but I can't verify that that 6-digit number is correct.
Why is it important that we can verify the notary? I know, but I'd like the audience to hear it.
Because if somebody is verifying a signature as being a true and correct signature of that person, the person verifying it has to be a real person, has to be a real notary. When you take out a loan, for example, from a bank, I mean, anybody who's bought a house knows how many papers they've got to sign and how many times the notary has to stamp the papers. Now, note, when you sign these papers, nowadays, the notary, what happens? You don't even go to an office. Usually, somebody comes to your house with a bunch of papers that you sign. Well, how does the bank know, because you didn't go into the bank to do this, how does the bank know that you're you, that you're a real person? They don't. They have to rely on the notary being allegedly independent to verify, I've looked at this person's ID. They have, usually it's a driver's license or it can be a passport, but I looked at their ID. This is a real person. This is a real ID. And I'm certifying that I've watched them sign this document in front of me. Okay? That's the only way a bank or a financial institution knows for sure that the person borrowing the money is a real person and really the person who's named on the documents. If the notary is a fraud, if the person handling notary is a fraud, then the whole process is a fraud. And nobody has any way of knowing that because the documents look legitimate.
Money laundering. That's how
money
it's done.
Laundering.
Yeah, exactly. That's how it's done. Exactly. I interviewed a gentleman years ago, a couple times. His name was John Cruz. He worked at HSBC Bank and he was a senior VP and he uncovered what you're talking about. Part of it, he uncovered a lot more and he said money laundering and they got caught because of his efforts, but they got slapped on the wrist. Nothing happened. No one went to jail. And I would imagine the same thing happens here.
Yeah, no, in fact, the book actually talks about this. We actually talk about the HBSC situation. We talk about Wells Fargo. We talk about Bank of America. We talk about Citibank. We talk about a number of ways in which involved in money laundering, both nationally and internationally, but including especially HBSC. It's one of the ones that's been probably the most involved in international laundering and especially with cartel money.
I want to connect a couple dots and have you comment on it. In the 2022 election, there were individual citizens, and I know because I've talked to a couple of them, they approached me to Tea Party group I was speaking to, and they said that they were ones that videotaped the voter fraud, the ballot stuffing, similar to what Dinesh D'Souza did in 2000 Mules for 2020 election. And they were called before a court, and they were told, you do this again, you're going to prison. Their argument was, hey, I'm outside the limits where you can't interfere in political activity. But the Supreme Court has said you can videotape whatever your eyes can see. And the judge says, you come back here again with these charges, you're going to prison. Let me link this to something else. And this is more rumor and innuendo, but I'm hearing it a lot, that the Sinaloa cartel launders money for the express purpose of recruiting younger lawyers to groom them to become judges so they can get these kind of decisions. Is that true or what you found or not?
True. More complicated than you put it, but true. The process, we talked about this last time, the process by which somebody becomes in Arizona is a huge deal. It is not done this way in any other state. We talk about judges as being elected, but before they are elected, they are generally, usually appointed. A space opens up and the governor appoints somebody. The problem is that in other states, you don't expect that the governor is going to know everybody. In a state like California, a huge state, there's no way the governor meets everybody, knows everybody. I mean, that would be ridiculous. So you have to have systems that find lawyers who want to be, who vet lawyers who want to be judges and go through a certain kind of weeding process. None of that occurs in Arizona. Exists. Firstly, the bar doesn't do anything. The bar, certainly will say if somebody's been suspended or somebody's not in good standing. But if you're in good standing, you qualify to be a judge, and that's the end of it. You're not nominated by a committee at the governor level. You're nominated locally by a local committee made up of 10 members in Maricopa County. It's made up of 10 members, two members from each, you know, each supervisorial district. One's a lawyer, one is not a lawyer. And they come in and they say, here, we want Joe Smith to be a judge. And somebody from the Avondale area, you know, will come in and say, well, I want, you know, Steve Jones to be, you know, to be nominated. And somebody will come in from the Scottsdale area and say, I want Mike Smith. And then, well, I'll support your guy if you support my guy, and they'll support your guy, and we all support each other's guy. And that's it. That's the entirety of the process. There is no vetting. There is no talking to peers. There are no peer reviews. There is no bar review or bar rating for that matter. If these two people in a particular district decide that they want that person, they simply make a deal with the people in the other districts over their persons. And that's it. That person then goes up to, you know, the governor, went up to Ducey, now up to Hobbs, and they become a judge. That's it. That's the vetting process. So it's very easy to slip in anybody you want, as long as they're a member of the bar. Now, with that being said, one of the problems, and I don't want to accuse any particular judge here of this, because it's too complicated to know the answer to. But one of the things that we have found that we report on in the book is that there are a ton of professionals in Arizona who never earned their degree, where the degree that they have is on paper, but never was earned. They never went. They never went to the school. And they may, in the case of lawyers, never pass the bar, never even took the bar. So that's one of the problems we're dealing with. We know for sure we have that with respect to real estate, both real estate agents and brokers. We know for sure we have that with respect to licensed clinical social workers. We know we have that with psychologists. We think we have that potentially with doctors as well, which is a very scary situation. And we have every reason to believe that with a number of lawyers, that they essentially bought the pieces of paper that got them to be considered attorneys.
I had an investigator who walked me through some cases in other states, exactly what you're describing. Exactly. And a lot of it was done, we found, for political reasons, to come in and make political decisions. John, we're just about out of time, and I wanted to talk about the book just for a second, but I got a lot of unanswered questions. We're going to have you back because it's like we open one door and there's three more to open and so forth. It's like a pyramid here going on. But anyway, your book is called The Report to the Governor. You know, I've been through it now. I've gone through the entire thing. And I got to tell you, I ask questions and you go, oh, yeah, that's right. I remember reading that now. I got to go back through some of this now. This is not the easiest read. It's articulate. It's easy to read vocabulary wise, but doggone it. I've never seen so much evidence, and I can see why they've tried to kill you.
Well, and the thing of it is that, you know, look, when I started this book, which was roughly late September of last year, you know, I was looking at a book that wasn't, you know, that was basically made for my five family members and my clients. You know, one of the things that we've talked about before is that when a case is kind of over, when we're essentially finished with the bulk of our investigation, I wouldn't say we write a book, but we put together a compendium of what we did, how we did it, especially when it's a year investigation. So this really started that way. And then, you know, in the midst of the writing, we had the November 2022 election. And so in addition to the fraud that we already knew of, which was not, you know, the hot topic of what we were writing about, but in the midst of that problem of what we knew from 2020, all of a sudden we could see exactly what had gone on in 2022. And, you know, because of how long it's taken, and remember, we're still in litigation. There's, you know, Hamadeh and Lake are still in litigation over the 2022 election. You know, it was very hard to put together the sequences that get you to the election fraud. This book took a lot longer to write than normal. But the other thing that you mentioned is that, look, we got
45 seconds. I'm sorry. But.
No problem. We talked about this before. We were originally looking at something short here, which was just simply, racketeering issues. And this then jumped from issue to issue to issue, and trying to explain how this is a cohesive set of issues is not simple. The book is Report to the Governor. It's 631 pages. It is available from our site, reporttothegovernor.com. It is available currently on a Kindle version. The e-version is available at Amazon. And the soft cover of the book will be available on Amazon, I believe, either tomorrow or Wednesday. We're just in the uploading process because of how large a book it is. It comes, as I said, with 507 footnotes. The footnotes are located not in the book to make it easier to read, but on our website. We've got the footnotes there, and those footnotes tie to over 5,000 pages of documents from the, the 150,000 or so pages of stuff that we researched.
That was fantastic. And my compliments to Jacqueline Brager for the concise presentation she made that unfortunately got Liz Harris kicked out of the legislature, but she was fantastic. John, I'm going to be in touch. I mean, we're opening up Pandora's box here, and I do appreciate you coming on. Great work. Good talking to you.
Dave, I appreciate it. I know you'll see the documents soon as well. And I know when you see those, you'll have even more questions for me.
Exactly. We'll see you, John. Thank you.
Thank you so much.